My grandmother said it's impossible to pray too much. We're going to do it just a little bit more of that, can we? Dear God, use me tonight as an instrument of thy will. Speak through me so whatever results that you desire here tonight will be accomplished. In all things, thy will, not mine, be done. Amen. The beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous for me lies in the simplicity of it, right? There's a passage in the book, and I ain't a guy that memorizes chapters and pages. This is a design for living, not an exercise in memorization, right? I mean, I can know what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but if I don't do what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to be somewhere drunk, only now I'm going to know why, right? Somebody will say to me, you've been in the bar since 8 o'clock this morning. Yes, I experienced the phenomenon of craving at about 8:10, right? This ain't about knowing, it's about doing. But there's a passage in the book that bottom lines the simplicity of AA for me. And what it says is simply this: remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people, it is dependent upon his relationship with God. The single most important fact in my life as I stand in Macon, Georgia tonight, and the only reason I'm standing in Macon, Georgia or anywhere else, is that I got a power in my life who does for me one day at a time what I could never do for myself. If I had the power to quit drinking on my own, I'd have never come to AA. Why should I? I didn't come here because I was bored. I didn't come here because I was lonely. I didn't come here because I needed a job or a girlfriend. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm powerless over alcohol and I cannot manage my own life. And I couldn't tell you that in those words when I got here, but that is exactly the reason that I came. And I found a power in here through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps as outlined by our founders. And that's the reason that I prayed before I introduced me from behind the podium, because I ain't here because of me. Left to my own devices, I would have surely destroyed myself years ago. My best two drinking buddies and my girlfriend from my drinking days all died as a direct result of alcoholism. Not indirectly, not kinda. They died as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism. That prayer reminds me of two things that I believe are vital and crucial to me staying here. First and foremost, the reason I'm here tonight is to do God's will, not Kent's. And it also serves to remind me that he is in charge here tonight. And as always, thank God, I am not. Good evening. My name is Kent Coleman. I'm an alcoholic. My parents raised me right. If my mother was here, she'd jump up and say, you didn't turn out right. But anyway, I want to thank the committee for the honor and the privilege of participating in the 64th prepaid. I tell you, I'm a simple guy. If selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the problem, it don't take a rocket scientist to figure out that unselfishness is the root of the solution. Anytime I'm asked to give in Alcoholics Anonymous, I say thank you. Whether it's setting up and cleaning up and mopping the floor at my home group, going into the jail, the detoxes, all of the things that I've been blessed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, just for that amount of time, get me out of the problem, which is me. Right? So that I can do something for somebody else. And I found out real quick here, that's how you stay here. So I want to thank the committee for your kindness, for your hospitality, for the wonderful basket in the room. I want to thank you for Barry, who got me down here in one piece. That was in question several times. Right? And I tell you, I've been to Georgia to speak many, many times over the years. And Georgia is a hotbed of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous in the state of Georgia. So it's an honor and a privilege to be here. I want to talk for a minute to our new friends here tonight, right? Because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have AA etiquette. Now, I just looked at my watch. That was for the benefit of the new people. I don't really care what time it is, but I just want to make y'all feel a little better. Lord knows I don't want to interrupt the karaoke tonight, right? I'm focused on the 13-step dance tomorrow, though. I'm working, right? But I came to AA with no AA addict because I'd never been here before, nor did I know a living human being who had been here before, or at least would admit having been here before. So I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got no AA etiquette. I don't know what an open meeting was. I don't know what a closed meeting was. I didn't know what a sponsor or a home group was. I didn't know a big book from a Rand McNally Atlas when I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I remember what it was like to be new. Nobody sprinkled pixie dust over my head, and all of a sudden, I get what y'all gonna say. Alcoholics Anonymous has its own vernacular. I come in here and y'all are saying things that don't make no sense to me, like one day at a time. I'm thinking to myself, yeah, genius, how do you live 2 days at a time, right? I don't get none of this stuff when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And so I come in here exactly as I was. I'm a street guy. I came off the street, and I came in here with a skill set. And it's all that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, a very simple skill set. And it's how I stayed alive in the street. And that skill set is watching and listening. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept you away from me. You know, y'all are nosy. Y'all are nosy. And see, when I came to AA, I don't know about nobody else in here. Maybe you got well when you walked into a meeting, but I came in here exactly as I was with my disease in full effect. My disease is active, and my disease active does not like you, right? Y'all are, you're nosy. You ask a lot of questions. Who's your sponsor? What's your home group? And here's the big one. What step are you on, right? So I learned real quick how to stay away from y'all. I come 2 minutes before the meeting start, and when they say amen, I'm the first one out that door, right? And that's what I'm doing, right? But I'm watching and I'm listening. And when I come in here, I saw two very clear, distinct groups of people. Now, I've stood behind podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world at this point in my life, and I've seen these two groups of people everywhere I've ever been. And that's people who are staying sober one day at a time and who seem to be happy and doing well, and people who are not, right? Now, I want to say something. We don't shoot our wounded in here, right? A lot of our best members, it took them more than once to get this thing. Here's what I want to share with you. I was asked to come here and share my experience. That is my experience. There's people in here who were doing well and people who weren't. The people who weren't were in and out, in and out. I noticed that every time they came back in from being out, they looked worse than the last time they came back in from being out. I didn't see none of them come in here passing out $100 bills and driving a new BMW and talking about how good it was out there, right? They came in here restless, irritable, and discontented and full of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. We'll call them group one. Not very attractive. I'm new in AA, but I'm not stupid. Okay? And then there's this other group of people. We'll call them group two. You've been here any amount of time, you go to any AA meeting, you'll see the group two people setting up the coffee, greeting people at the door, putting up the tables and chairs, setting out the literature. They talk about God, big book, steps, spirituality, enjoying life sober and helping others, right? We'll call them group two. Now, as I said earlier, I'm no rocket scientist, but I figured out real quick that these group two people got a heck of a better deal than these group one people, right? So keeping this simple, and I'm brand new, I asked myself, well, what do these people do that these people don't? Because obviously there is a difference, right? So these group two people had some things in common. They had something called a sponsor. Now, I didn't know what a sponsor was when I came to AA. I used to play softball for Cronin's Tavern. They was our sponsor. And I got a lot of free booze and clothes out of that deal, and I thought, well, maybe this AA thing ain't so bad, right? And of course, y'all sat me down and told me what a sponsor was. You told me a sponsor is somebody who has working knowledge and experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as outlined by the founders in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, who is willing to take the time to walk you through that book. But just as importantly, in my opinion, even more importantly, is a living demonstration of those principles in their life, who can show you through the power of their example what your life can be like if you do what they do. Right? They told me when I came here, this ain't for people who want it, it ain't for people who need it, it's for people who do it. Wanting it and needing it ain't enough. I have sponsorship in AA today. I'm sponsored by a guy named Bob who lives in Las Vegas. I think he's been here before a couple times. And I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous by the late Bill Finley in Lorain, Ohio. And Bill died over 50 years sober, and Ken B. in Parma. And Kenny is still, and I talk to Kenny every week. Man, and I'm going to tell you something about the people who have helped me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you the truth. I never had a conversation with any of the three of them, right, where they asked me what I was doing tonight. They always told me what they were doing tonight. That's the example that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, to our new friends in here, having a sponsor is a great thing. Being sponsorable is even better. Right? I work with a lot of alcoholics. Somebody asked me recently, Ken, how many people do you sponsor? I said, oh, about half of them. Is that not the truth, right? I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsorship is like everything else. You only get out of it what you put into it. I will tell you this, and this is how I am with my sponsor now. I try to be the kind of sponsee to him that I expect my sponsees to be to me. Okay? I remain accountable and transparent with my sponsor. I've been sober long enough now, ain't no shame in my game. I am not willing to suffer by my own hand anymore. I am not willing to do so. And I make mistakes on a daily basis, and I got a 12-step program that allows me to recognize and rectify them by the practice of the principles of this program. And I don't have to live like that anymore, right? I like to do this sometimes. It's a lot of people in here tonight. Would everybody in here tonight who would be willing to sponsor a new person in AA, please raise your hand. Thank you very much. For all of you who don't have a sponsor, I just hooked you up. No one ever need leave an AA meeting without the benefit of sponsorship, Bill used to say. And let me share something with you, right? Everybody laughs when I do that. I'm serious when I do that. Because I remember what it's like to be new. When I came in here, I don't know if you got 10 years or 10 minutes, nor do I know whether you'd be willing to help a guy like me who didn't even feel he deserved any help. So all of you who don't have a sponsor, the help you need just identified itself. What you do with that information is entirely up to you. It's entirely up to you. I did a thing down in Mexico a few years ago, and I had an interpreter, you know. And in the thank you line, a young lady came up to me speaking rapidly in Spanish and pointing at this older lady. Well, I don't speak rapid Spanish. I don't even speak slow Spanish, right? And the interpreter says to me, she's telling you, Kent, that she just asked that lady to be her sponsor. And I don't know if that was the only reason I was in Mexico. I really don't, right? So if you ain't got a sponsor, you don't have to leave here without one tonight. Right? Another thing them people had in common, they had something called a home group, right? And they told me, if you ain't got a home group, you're homeless in AA. And this is the last place in the world a guy like you can afford to be homeless, right? So I have a home group today. It's the Venice Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sandusky, Ohio. We began as an Oxford group meeting in 1938. We've been around for a while. I'm going to tell you something about my home group. Right? My home group ain't the best group in the world. It ain't the worst group in the world. It's just an AA group. One of the things that my first sponsor taught me when I came into AA is it's okay to stop competing now. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a competition. It's a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. Prior to coming into AA, everything in my life was lived on a comparative basis, and I'm either better than or less than. And here's a funny thing that happens when I live better than or less than, I am not a part of. And being not a part of Alcoholics Anonymous for a guy like me is fatal. If you look at tradition one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Anytime I separate myself from you as better than or less than, I am on my way out that door and I don't even know it. I am on my way out that door. I'm a member of an AA group. We have a primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I think we do a pretty good job of that, and we have a lot of fun in the process. And that's what I like to call the total package in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sponsorship, big book and steps, home group, and a service commitment. In my experience, I have yet to meet an alcoholic of our type. And if you don't know what an alcoholic of our type is, read the book. I've yet to meet an alcoholic of our type who's come in here, taken those things, applied them to their life one day at a time to the best of their ability, and that's not perfect. For those of you who come in AA like me and you beating yourself up on a daily basis because you ain't perfect and you ain't doing that, God does not require that. God only requires that I do the best that I can this day with what I have. Right? God loves me irregardless. I ain't got to prove nothing to God. God's love is immutable. It's immutable. I have it anyway. Just do the best I can. I've yet to see one of us come in here and do that and go back out here and take a drink. I have not seen it happen one single time. Now, I've seen people come in here and do it and stop doing it and drink again. But to do it one day at a time, I have not seen it happen one single time. For those of you who are new, the program of recovery is designed for success, not for failure. There is no failure. I just do the best I can each day. On the flip side of the coin, I've yet to see an alcoholic of our type come in here, ignore those things, and stay sane, sober, or happy for any appreciable length of time. The simplicity of Alcoholics Anonymous, those who do get and those who don't, and it's just that simple. It's just that simple. My sponsor Bill used to say, I never sat in a bar room and watched somebody drink and thought I was going to get drunk watching them drink. That's just as ridiculous as me coming in here, watching you get a sponsor, work the steps, get active in a group and help other people and think that somehow magically it's going to rub off on me. The 12 steps says haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, not a spiritual awakening as a result of attendance. Is attendance important? Is attendance important? You better believe attendance is important. You better believe attendance is important. But let me explain something if you're new. We got a lot of stuff here. We got meetings, literature, conferences and conventions. Man, we got workshops going on. The dissemination of information in Alcoholics Anonymous is at an all-time high in 2017. But all of those things have a purpose, and that is to facilitate the 12-step process in my life. None of them are a substitute for it. And as soon as I understood that, then AA started to make some sense. Right? Because I was hearing a lot of different things. Right? I identified myself as an alcoholic when I came up here. I didn't know what that was when I got here either. Of course, I wouldn't tell you that because I thought I knew everything when I got here. Right? I always had a definition of alcoholism. It was a sliding definition. Because as my disease progressed, I kept fitting my definitions. So every time I fitted, I'd have to lower the bar a little bit. When I was a teenager, you'd ask who the alcoholic was. I'd say somebody drunk every day. I don't know where I got that from. TV, listen to grown people talk. I have no idea. But as a teenager, I became a daily drinker. That ain't it. I figured it out. An alcoholic is somebody who misses work, school, ball practice, important things in life because of drinking. It interferes with your priorities in life. That must be an alcoholic. As a teenager, I began to miss work, school, ball practice, important things in life because of drinking. That ain't it. I thought about it some more. I finally figured it out. An alcoholic is somebody who goes to jail because of drinking. That certainly must be it. As you'll hear in a few minutes, I really had to change that one. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my definition, right? No, y'all remember Otis on the Andy Griffith Show? Y'all remember Otis? Otis, he always had a pint on him. He was in and out of jail. I don't remember Otis working no place on the Andy Griffith Show, right? True story, I was over in London, England, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, speaking, and I asked him, do y'all remember Otis on the Andy Griffith Show? And 2,000 people went, no. Not one of my greater moments as a speaker. Took me about 10 minutes to recover from that. I was shocked. But you know what I'm talking about. the guy under the bridge, long trench coat, stocking cap on his head, drinking Wild Irish Rolls, Mad Dog, a Thunderbird out of brown paper sack, and sleeping under a cardboard box. Yes, that certainly must be an alcoholic. That was my definition when I got to you, and the reason that it was is those are the only things that had not yet happened to me. And if I didn't have the family that I had that insisted for many, many years on breaking every fall I had, that is exactly where I would have been. I can stand here tonight in all honesty and tell you I drank in Wino's Alley in Sandusky, Ohio with them old men. The only difference between me and them old men is when it got dark, there was still somebody to open the back door for me, and there was nobody left to do it for them. I know what it's like to put 50 cents on a wine at 7 o'clock in the morning in an alley in downtown Sandusky. I know what that's like. I've been there. I've done that. Right? So what is this thing called alcoholism? Right? Well, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is laid out in three parts. What is the problem? What is the solution? Then it gives me a practical program of action to apply the solution to my life. Right? So the first thing it tells me is a problem, right? And what is the problem? And it starts with the doctor's opinion, where Dr. Silkworth talks about mental, physical, and spiritual aspects of this disease, right? The mental part of it, he called the mental obsession to drink, right? We call it the obsession to drink. What is an obsession? Right? An obsession is a thought so strong and so powerful, it will override or overcome any thinking that I can raise as a defense against it. What are some of the mental defenses I've tried to raise against taking the first drink? Well, I tried common sense. That was stupid. I'm not going to do that again. Right? And of course, I did it again the next day. Self-knowledge. I sat in a bar 1979, and I said to a kid named Brian sitting next to me, you know how you had moments of clarity sometime? I said, if I drink that bottle of beer, I'm not going to do one single solitary thing I told you I got to do today. Brian, being a sane human being, looked at me and said, then don't drink it. Right? Right? My response to him was, well, now that I know that, I can drink it and stop, right? So I drank it. And y'all know what happened. I didn't do nothing I was supposed to do that day, right? I tried fear of consequences I might face. I used to wake up in the morning. I'm talking about in my late teens, early 20s. Lay in the bed, stare at the ceiling, and make a list of all the reasons why I ain't drinking today. If I drink today, I'm going to lose my job, get kicked out of school, get kicked off the team, girlfriend going to leave me, get kicked out of the house, dirty urine, I'm going to prison, might die. All of these things true in my life at one time or another. And if you drink like I drink, usually three or four of them going on simultaneously, right? So I lay in the bed, take a look at the truth, because all those things were true, and I would make a decision based on truth. I ain't drinking. And I want you to understand something. I meant it as much then as I mean it tonight. I didn't want those things in my life any more than I want them now. I ain't drinking. And then I get out of the bed. Now, our book refers to that first thought. It says it's sound reasoning. And it is sound reasoning, isn't it? It's based on truth, right? Drink trouble. Don't want the trouble? I ain't drinking. That's sound reasoning. But the book goes on to say that parallel to that sound reasoning ran some insanely, let's circle the word insanely in your book, trivial excuse to take a drink. Because here's the thought that comes to me 5 minutes later. It's Friday. If you knew, follow me for a minute. It's Friday, and you know, none of this is really my fault. I've worked all week, which for me is 3 days. This is the United States of America. I'm grown. I ain't hurting anybody. And by God, I deserve a beer. Is anybody following me? Right? Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? They will lock you up for that kind of thinking. You're looking at a guy who got sentenced to 5 years in the state penitentiary. I stood in front of a judge in the Erie County Courthouse who told me, I'm going to put you on a period of indefinite probation. I was going to protest that, but my lawyer had my arm like this. And if you come in here, have one dirty urine, so much as an aspirin, Mr. Coleman, you're going to do them 5 years. I walked out of that courtroom, you know what I said, don't you? I'll never drink again. Just got the break of a lifetime, right? I get off work the next Friday morning. I work midnights. It's 8 a.m. They open adult probation at 9 a.m. I got an hour to kill. As I'm driving across town, here's the thought that came to me. You know, they say they never test you on your first time reporting. They don't think anybody's that stupid. Is anybody? Who is they? Who is they? I turn into the Super Bowl Tavern, finger goes up, 8 ounce water glass of old granddad in a Miller wash. And I stagger into adult probation, facing 5 years in the penitentiary. And I didn't do that because I'd rather be in prison than be free. I want to talk about being powerless. I died in 1984. I died as a direct result of the use of alcohol and some of its cousins. And I dropped dead one day, upset my girlfriend a great deal. She called the rescue squad, they put the paddles on me. I'm in the cardiac unit, absolute chaos. My family, her family, Reverend Brown, the Catholic priest, just chaos, the alcoholic. The book says tornado, I'm a full-blown cyclone. I lay in there with tears running down the side of my face, wires all over my chest. God, if you let me live, I'd never drink again, and I meant it as much as I mean it now. I didn't want to die no more then than I want to die today. I spent 48 hours in the cardiac unit. They rolled me down, said my heartbeat was stable. A medical miracle, they said. Oh, thank you. They rolled me down the hallway, put me in a regular room outside the cardiac unit. Here's the thought that came to me. Whoa, that was close. But I'm all right now. This calls for a celebration. 2 hours out of the cardiac unit, I'm getting loaded in the hospital. I'm powerless over alcohol. I spend a lot of time. Doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution more about alcoholism. I do a book study that's Skyped around the country, and we spend months on that. Because this is a thing that has to be internalized, not intellectualized. It'll kill me up here. It's got to go from here to here. When I say fully concede to my innermost self, concession is internal. Confession is external. I have confessed many times. To get you off my back and into my corner, so next time when I do it again, right, I know I can count on you. Silkworth goes on and talks about the phenomenon of craving, the physical aspect of the disease, right? True story. The simplest I can explain the phenomenon of craving. He says it's an allergy to alcohol. An allergy is an abnormal reaction. Right? I'm out cutting my grass. I'm 10 or 12 years sober. So is my non-alcoholic next door neighbor. I'm watching him. He get hot and thirsty. He shut his lawnmower off. He get off it. He walked over to his deck. He flipped open a cooler. It was full of cold ones. He pulled out a cold one, he popped the top on her, he sucked it down, it quenched his thirst, and I know nobody in here is going to believe this, but I've seen this with my own two eyes. With that full cooler of beer still sitting there, that man actually got back on his lawnmower and finished cutting his grass. I'm 10 or 12 years sober, I'm over here going, Right? Because I don't get that. There's beer here. The difference between me and my neighbor, I get off of my lawnmower, I pop the top on the cold one and suck her down. It does not quench my thirst. Right? If you're new in here, follow me. What it does to me, and maybe to you, is it makes me thirstier. And grass cutting is over at the Coleman house. My lawnmower be in that same spot in 2 weeks when I get out of the county. The Kessler's next door. Look, Gladys, there he goes again, right? And I'm headed up the street. Spiritual malady, soul sickness. My disease is rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness. I'm a guy who made a conscious decision at a very early age that I did not need God or anybody else telling me how to run my life. And as a direct result of making that decision, I began to have to do some things, right? I began to have to try to control and manipulate the people, places, and things in my life to satisfy me. Because that's what it's all about, isn't it? I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, right? So I decide that out there, outside of me, are the answers to my problems, right? And there's a funny thing that happens when you try to control and manipulate the people around you to satisfy those basic needs that Bill talks about in the 12 and 12. The need for security, the need for companionship, the need for sex. When you start trying to control the people around you, funny thing happens. They refuse to cooperate. And as a result of that, I push harder, I pull harder, right? I want to talk about spirit. When we talk about restless, irritable, and discontented, we're talking about a condition of spirit. And the spirit is like, anybody know what a divining rod is, right? That they used to go around in the desert trying to find water underground, right? That's what a deficient spirit does. Is it looks for fulfillment. Now, we in here, we talk about the God-sized hole, don't we? Right? And we know that only a power greater than ourselves can fulfill our spirit. Right? But for a long time, that ain't. So what happens when my spirit, and this happens to me even today, if my spirit is at dis-ease, I will start looking for something, right, to make me feel better. Maybe it's her. Maybe it's that car, that promotion, that something. I am restless, irritable, and discontented. So the most important thing in my life, and watch what happens. I'm a watcher in AA. Have you ever seen somebody 25 or 30 years sober destroy their life in here without picking up a drink? Gambling. I've seen the knife and fork. I've seen sex. I've seen materialism. Restless, irritable, and discontented. Silkworth goes on to say, and this is where he gets me, just nails me. He goes on to say, until I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once from taking a few drinks. Drinks I see other people taking without consequence. So when am I restless, irritable, and discontented? I'm restless, irritable, and discontented sober. The book goes on and Wilson tells us that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. A spiritual malady demands a spiritual solution, not a financial, relationship, or intellectual solution. It demands a spiritual solution, a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And it's just that simple. Nothing else will work. So my problem, which I thought was alcohol, which is a great problem, right? But when the book said alcohol is but a symptom of what? It's but a symptom of a much larger problem that's in here. The phenomenon of craving, right? How do you treat that? Don't take the first drink. What does Silkworth say? Entire abstinence. Right? But how do I not take the first drink? By treating the condition of my spirit. So that I can experience ease and comfort sober. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This disease of mind, body, and spirit is called alcoholism. If you got it, and I don't know if you do, but I definitely do, and I don't treat it, death, imprisonment, or commitment are absolutely guaranteed me. And if you're new in here and you don't understand that, stick around and watch what happens to the people who don't. You can learn everything you need to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous by watching and listening. I was born in the city of Sandusky. I was the second of three boys. I'm a middle child, Katie. I was raised in a Christian home. I had as fine a mother and father that have ever graced this earth. I'm the son of Pete and Evelyn Coleman. My mother worked for Chrysler Corporation. My father worked for General Motors. I'm retired from Ford. Yeah. And then we had a lot of problems in the house, but we had really nice cars. Anyway, I grew up, you couldn't have a better deal. My mother was the president of Ohio Baptist Women's Convention. A lot of famous people from this part of the country have been in my home. My mother was a very powerful person. She was the highest ranking woman in Chrysler Corporation in the 1960s and 1970s. You know, I worked, when I retired from Ford, I was working in Dearborn. And they called us the best and the brightest. And I never worked with anybody as smart as my mother. My mother was a power. If my mother walked in this hall right now, God rest her soul, it would get twice as bright in here. My father was commissioner of the youth baseball and football programs in our town. My grandmother cooked for everybody in town. My mother's older brother was two-term mayor of the city of Sandusky. That's the kind of family that I come from. We went on vacations every year, 10 speeds, mini bikes, motorcycles. When I went off to college, I peeled a sticker out of the window of a brand new car and drove off. It's the kind of mother and father that I had. We were not sent to church. We were taken to church. You know, Bill Wilson talks about the steps, and he calls them a set of principles, spiritual in nature. I was introduced to spiritually principled living long before I got out of the front yard of the house. In our house, they taught us honesty is the best policy. A real man is always honest with himself and other people. In my house, maybe in some of y'all, we got automatic whoopings when we got caught lying. Did that happen in anybody else's house in here? Welcome to step one. The principle of step one is honesty. I learned it at the end of a hickory stick. I'm 6 or 7 years old. My mother calls me in the living room and she says, Kenny, I'm concerned about you. This was the first of a million of these conversations. And she said, contrary to what you seem to believe, the sun don't rise when you wake up and set when you go to bed. Look out the window and tell me what you see. Sky, grass, cars, dog, cats, people. She said, you think this just popped up out of nowhere? There's a power that's greater than you that created all this, and all you have to do is be willing to believe that. Step two. In our house, they told us, if you will make a decision to put your life in the hands of the power that created all this, in my house, they called that power God. They said, you will always have what you need, no matter what happens outside or around you. They was teaching us the answers inside, not outside, step three. In our house, they told us, anytime you got a problem, no matter how bad you think it is, come talk to us about it. A problem shared is a problem half solved. You're only as sick as your secrets. No man is an island. Anybody ever heard that stuff before? That's steps four and five. My mother used to say the biggest room in a human being's life is the room for improvement. There's no perfect people. If you can make B's, you can make A's. And if you'll ask the power that created all of this to help you grow positively in any area of your life, the power will always do so because that's what the power does. That's step six and seven. In our house, they told us anytime you hurt, harm, or wrong somebody else, go make right the wrong you're done. If you owe money, pay it. If you owe an apology, make it. If you owe time, give it. Clean up your mess. That's what responsible people do. Anybody ever heard that before? That's steps eight and nine. My mother used to say, You can never go forward in life if you don't know where you are today and what you need to work on to get wherever it is you're trying to go. How can you go somewhere if you don't know where you are? Try it sometime. Right? I read a book about Socrates when I was in the 11th grade, and he said, the unexamined life is a waste. Right? Step 10. Our grandmother told us the secret to having a good day is a real simple deal. Wake up in the morning, slide out of the bed onto your knees, say one word, please. As you go through the day and you don't know what to do, ask the power that created all of this to help you. And at night before you get back into bed, hit your knees again, say two words, thank you. Conscious contact with God all the lived long day, step 11. And in my house, they told us the greatest thing we could do with our lives was not acquire money or material things. It was to be of service to others. We was taught to follow the golden rule. Talk to folk the way you want to be talked to. Treat folk the way you want to be treated. Offer to share what you have with others before you have your own. Be of service to your fellow man. Step 12. When I got on the bus to go to kindergarten, I was already armed with a set of principles, spiritual in nature, that I recognized immediately when I came in here as the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I bet some of y'all was too. I bet some of y'all was too. Now, those principles are ancient. And there's a lot of people who live like that out there in the world every single day, and they don't expect a pat on the back for it either. It's crazy in here, ain't it? This is the only place in the world. I got a 45-year-old man at my dining room table, and I'm telling him, look, you, tomorrow, I want you to go do something for somebody other than yourself. And if you tell anybody, it doesn't count. Right? Such is the depth of the selfishness and self-centeredness of guys like me. Right? I was 7 months sober. I went to see my grandmother. I said, Mama, guess what? She said, what? I said, I paid my bills 7 months in a row. She said, I paid mine 72 years in a row. Get out of my house. It's crazy in here. 4 million people get a job in the United States every day. Alcoholic get a job, we rent a union hall and throw a party. Unbelievable, ain't it? So if I had all that stuff before I went off to kindergarten, you were already thinking to yourself, well, what are you doing leading an AA meeting tonight? I bet you know the answer to that too, don't you? I never did any of it. I talked about it a lot. You ever be down at the tavern and it'd be some drunk in there quoting scripture? That was me. I'd be down at Brownlee's Tavern on Friday night. Somebody be having a meltdown. Somebody would meltdown down Brownlee's every Friday night, usually because they was losing their job, getting divorced, or going to jail. And Kent would stagger over with a drink in his hand and say something like this. Luke chapter 5, verses 11 to 17 tell us, I'm quoting scripture down to Brownlee's Tavern, giving spiritual guidance. And I didn't stop there. I give marital advice down to Brownlee's. I had never had a wife, but I didn't see how that made a difference. With my life savings laying on the bar, I was a financial counselor down to Brownlee's. My father called me a walking encyclopedia of perfectly useless information. We was down in the ballpark one day. My father said to a guy sitting next to us, would you like to buy a complete brand new set of the Encyclopedia Britannica? The man said, well, maybe, but why would you be selling a brand new set of the Encyclopedia Britannica? My father said, we got a boy over here who knows everything. Ha, 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 ha. I did not think it was funny. As a kid growing up, I was a shy kid. You hear it all. You know, I'm insecure. I'm afraid of my own shadow. Absolutely terrified. And you know how it is. You can't let nobody know that. So I act the opposite, right? I'm a tough guy. I'm a bully. That's how I keep you away from me. I will do whatever I got to do to keep you away from me because I'm scared of everything, right? I've never felt connected always separate. You know, Chamberlain used to say there is but one problem which encompasses all problem, and that's conscious separation from God and our fellows. There is but one solution in which is encompassed all solutions, and that's conscious contact with God and our fellows. And that's what happens to us in here. But I walk through the universe, and even when I'm surrounded by people, I'm terrified of girls. I always feel like I'm a half a step behind everybody else in the things in life that really matter. And what really matters when you're a youngster? Being cool. That's what really matters, right? And I'm not cool, right? And that's how I feel growing up. So I start looking for something to make me feel better. I start looking outside of me, right? I learned how to read before I could go to school. Big advantage when I got to school. I lost myself in books. I lost myself in television and movies. I lost myself in daydreaming. I'm somebody else, someplace else, doing something else. I did not understand at that time in my life that I'm already looking for avenues of escape from the reality of my life. The reality of my life was an uncomfortable place for me. And so I'm starting to look for something, right, to make me feel better. My first real drink of choice was my older brother. I come from a football community. I come from a football state. Hello, Georgia. And in the great state of Ohio, my father, my family plays football. That's what we do. My father played at West Virginia State. My Uncle Bo played at Penn State University. I had two cousins who played in the National Football League for over 10 years. That's what we do, is we play football. And I had a brother who was 16 years old. He was 6'2". He weighed 215 pounds. He could run a 4.44 on a cinder track. And I followed him everywhere that he went. I ran into his best friend at the store, at the grocery store the other day. And his best friend said, "Man, your brother was the kind of guy, he could outrun at the size he was. He had sprinter speed. He was a big-time hurdler in the state of Ohio." He said he could outrun everybody on the field, but when he broke the line of scrimmage, he went looking for somebody to hit. Because he was the best running back in Ohio, and he wanted you to know that when he left the stadium. And that was with my brother. My brother was a very gifted guy. And September 1972, my brother is injured in a scrimmage in Massillon, Ohio. We used to scrimmage Massillon every year. And make a long story short, he fell funny. Later on, collapsed, wasn't breathing. Lapsed into a coma Saturday night, 9 hours of brain surgery on Monday. He died on Wednesday, September the 5th, 1972. I remember like it was yesterday. No, my brother had agreed to go to Ohio State University to play football for the late Woody Hayes. Is that what made me alcoholic? No. No. Stop any car out on the street. People live, people die, tragedies happen. It's life, isn't it? What it did to me, and maybe some of you will understand this, it seemed to increase the separation that already existed in my life. Because now, everywhere that I go, there's an elephant in the room. And this is 1972. We didn't know how to deal with this. No one did. So everywhere I go, there's an uncomfortable silence because the guy whose brother died is now in the room, and no one. And there's an awkward silence everywhere I go. And I'm even more alone. And that's how I felt. My mom used to talk to me a lot after my brother died, and she used to tell me, you know, God's been really good to you. You're going to have a great life. I used to tell my mom that I ain't got no desire to be of service to God, you or anybody else. If you want to know what I want out of life, I can tell you real quick. I want mine. I want to get it my way. I'm going to need you to leave me alone while I'm doing it. My mother would get that look on her face. You know that look mothers get on their face when they realize one of their kids is crazy? And she would get that look on her face, and she said, "You don't get it. We didn't raise you that way." And I used to say, "Nah, you don't get it. Just wait and see." Right? And one of the gifts God did give me is I did well in school. I give God credit for that. I wasn't challenged by school. I didn't put any effort into it. I didn't work for it. School just came easy for me. Right? And but I always took the credit. I always, anything good, I take the credit. Anything bad, I'm blaming you. That's how I live my life. And my first sponsor, Bill, said to me one day, he said, "You know, anytime you're in a room alone, all your enemies are there." And he was referring to my thinking. I'm 14 years old. I'm sitting in study hall at Sandusky High School, and I'm watching people doing their homework. Here's the thought that came to me. These people breaking their neck trying to get B's and C's, taking general math and science. I'm taking calculus, physics, fourth year Latin, fourth year English. I'm in the 10th grade. I'm sleeping in class and getting straight A's. You know, it just might be entirely possible that I know everything. I had no evidence to support that thought as being true. I accepted it as a fact. I left the room and I took action on it. I went home and told that to my mother and father. I thought they ought to know. You know, I was scared of my father. My father played football when he didn't have face masks. My father was a decorated veteran in the Korean War. My father was in the woods in Korea. And my father, when I made that statement, he like this, like he was coming up off the couch. I decided not to wait to see what he wanted. To the day my father died, I never asked him what he intended to do to me that day. He must have been thinking, look what we got in the house, I'm going to kill it. Anyway, I broke for the screen door, and I closed the screen door, and he's right behind me. And my father pointed that finger at me. He said, boy, I'm going to tell you something. He said, you have a hard life, Kenny. He said, because don't nobody know everything. And I looked my father dead in his eye, and I laughed in his face. And that was a significant day in my life, because on that day, I closed the door. Our book says honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are the three essentials of recovery. Not only are they the three essentials of recovery, they're the three essentials of a healthy life, whether you're an alcoholic or not. On that day, I became a no. I became a no. A yes is an open-minded, tolerant, willing to learn, willing to accept kind of person. I'm a no. When you walk up on me, I'm sizing you up. I done already figured out what's wrong with you and why you ain't as good as me. Anybody in here know what I'm talking about? I walk through life and I'm a no. Selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, self-absorbed, and according to my mother, mean as a rattlesnake, I had yet to take a drink of alcohol. I tell people I was the perfectly tilled soil for the disease of alcoholism. All I had to do was water it and see if I had the physical, and of course I did. I got in a car with a guy whose life I lived in my head, because I don't live in the real world with the rest of you. He was 2 years older than me. He was the captain of the basketball team at Sandusky High School. I played basketball up there. He was my best friend's older brother. We all played up there in the mid-70s. Snazzy car, pocket full of money, ran around with the kind of girls I ran away from. I got in the car with Johnny. He looked at me and said, hey, Coleman, you want to get something to drink? I have been warned about drinking alcohol because alcoholism does not run in my family. It gallops. And I have been told we do not do alcohol. Both sides of my family are rife with this disease. Right? But understand this, and if you're new in here, follow me. If Johnny had said to me that day, let's go rob the carry out, I would have done it. That's how empty I am on the inside. I was addicted to approval long before I picked up a drink of alcohol. Something outside of me to address this in here. We drove through the drive-thru. We bought 10 quarts of Swiss Malt Liquor Bull. To the youngsters in here, the quart preceded the 40 ounce. It was 32 ounces of beer. And we got Swiss Malt Liquor Bull for one reason. It was on sale. More bang for your buck, the guy said, right? We dropped the beautiful top on that lovely Pontiac with the quarter walls, the baskets, and the spinners, cranked up the Parliament Funkadelic, and we rolled through the streets of Sandusky, and we drank that beer, and my life changed. I've heard a lot of descriptions of what happens when that alcoholic gets that first drink. Here's what I can tell you. I went from shy, insecure, and afraid to bold, confident, suave, debonair, and absolutely fearless in about 20 minutes. We went behind the Derrick apartments where all the thugs hung out. I ain't said 5 words in public in the last 3 years. People surrounded the car. The music was blasting. I told Johnny, turn that music down because there's a few things I want to tell a few people who are here this afternoon that I have been wanting to tell them for quite some time. I went around that circle of hoodlums, told each and every one of them what I thought of them and what they needed to do, in my opinion, to improve themselves. I don't just tear you down. I build you back up. The reaction of the boys around the car, dudes is leaning in the car hugging me. He says, see, I told you. I told you Coleman, all right. He's loosened up. He's drinking. He's one of us. Boom, I connected a dot. When I drink, I change. And so do you. And so do you. Right? And I now have the approval of the people whose approval I want the most. That wasn't mom and dad. That was them drive-by shooters behind the Derrick apartments. Alcohol equals success. And you better believe, buddy, I got it. We left from there. We went over to the home of some of them girls he run around with, I run away from. I'd never been over there in my life. I walked into that home like I had just paid off the mortgage. I sat down at the dining room table, looked across the dining room. I made eyeball-to-eyeball contact with the finest girl to graduate from Sandusky High School in its 170-year history. I had never even breathed in her direction, much less said hello. And I looked over there at her, and she looked at me, and I said, come here. And she got up and started walking toward me. Now, any sane human being would probably think, gee, Ken, if you wasn't so shy and scared, look what you could have done by speaking up. Is that what I thought? Absolutely not. If you knew, follow me. Here's what I thought. If you had been drinking before now, look what you could have done. Look what you've been missing. Alcohol equals success, and you better believe, buddy, I got it. I got it. Now, this is an honest program, to be honest with y'all tonight. When she got over there to me, I didn't have the faintest idea what to do with her. I don't think that far ahead when I'm drinking. But I watch a lot of TV because I got a lot of time on my hands. On TV, they go like this. And I did. And she sat down in my lap. And my life changed again. And the upshoot to that whole little story is on that day, alcohol did for me what I could not or would not do for myself. What happened the rest of that day is the rest of my drinking history, and we can get out of it. Drink trouble. Right? What happened is this. I went into a blackout. I have no idea what went on the next 4 or 5 hours. According to eyewitnesses at the house, I came in, threw up a trail through the house. My grandfather fell on the floor laughing. I went in the bathroom. I hit everything but the toilet. The next thing I remember is my mom knocking on that bath. You know how they do. Come out here and clean up this mess. You know you've been drinking. Blah, 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 blah. I staggered into the hallway in what later years would be my drinking uniform, my underwear. I got a hangover you can take out and look at. I'm dying. I go in the bathroom, lock the door. She's still screaming in the hallway. I'm looking her bloodshot eyes into the mirror, and this is what I said. Man, oh man, I cannot wait to do it again. Anybody in here follow me? Grounded for life is what was being discussed in the living room, and how that sentence was, I got grounded for life. I'm a drink trouble guy. Now, there's a lot of people who come to AA, and you ain't been in no big trouble. You ain't been to jail. You ain't had DUIs. You don't have to. You can get off the elevator at any floor. The price of admission here is honesty, not the penitentiary. But that ain't my experience. If this here was a drink of alcohol, and I stood here and had a drink tonight, a cop would drop right out of that light and land in the middle of this floor over here. I'm sorry, but that's just the truth. So I had a meeting with myself in the bathroom. I love to have a meeting with myself. I have a meeting with myself. I can solve most anything that's going on. If you're new in here and you'd like to have a meeting with yourself, please get a sponsor. I had a meeting with myself, and this is what I come up with. Okay, Kent, you got drunk, yep, you got sick, yep, and you got grounded for life. All these things are true. Now, the reason, Kent, you got grounded for life is not because you got drunk. The reason you got grounded for life is because you got sick. So what you got to do is learn how to drink without, come on, getting sick. Oh, I knew I was home. This is absolute insanity. You know why? Because for many, many years to follow, alcohol's an answer for me. It's not a problem. And the world doesn't understand that, do they? You know, when I first understood it, when I was laying in a detox bed and a man came down and sat down next to me, and he's the first person who ever talked to me, not about my drinking, but about his. And he totally disarmed me. Because as soon as you say to me, you got a problem with alcohol, the wall goes up because you don't understand. Alcohol's not the problem. The police are the problem. She's the problem. Ford Motor Company, Miami University. Right? Never booze. Anybody follow me? And I was to live that way many, many years. And I was gone. I was gone. 16 years old, they gave me a car. I went to Toledo, Ohio. I had a driver's license that said I was 22 years old. I put on a three-piece suit, shirt, and a tie. I went to the all-beautiful Shea nightclub in Toledo, Ohio. At least that's what they said on the radio. That ain't what it was when I got there, but it didn't matter. And I had a 1 a.m. curfew, and at 1 a.m., I was sipping on a gin and juice and slow dragging with a woman older than my mother. That's a true story. I come home at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to sneak in the house. Y'all know how that goes, right? I turn around the corner, house lit up like a Christmas tree. Well, they ain't going to, right? So in the front door I go. There's my mother sitting on the couch, tears running down her face. This is what my mother told me. As your parents, we owe you roof over your head, food to eat, clothes on your back, and an education. We've done it. She said, but buddy, I got something you can't have, and that's my peace of mind. She said, Kenny, you going to penitentiary or the cemetery? And I got news for you, buddy. I ain't going with you. I'm giving you to God. I'm done. Go do what you want. I'm done. I'm 16 years old. This is what I said to my mom. I broke you. And I want you to know something, Mama. I'm a little bit disappointed. You such a spiritual giant. Because it wasn't even that hard. And that's how I treated my mom. How you think I treated you? Dr. Bob Smith said something in his story, The Doctor's Nightmare. I live my life without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of any other human being. I walk this earth like there was nobody here but me. The only use you had to me is what I could get from you. I spent 5 years at Miami University, one of the best schools in the country, Miami of Ohio. I was drunk the whole time I was there. They gave me a degree, but I'm living proof you can get a degree and no education. My alcoholism progressed. When I got to college, trust me. See, this is why I don't get up here and talk about the good times I had drinking. You know what my definition of a good time drinking is? That any consequences that have to be paid as a result of my actions are paid by somebody else. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and I'm a pig. And I don't care about nobody. And that's just the truth. I never did nothing for another human being that didn't have a string attached to it. You best believe it. I'm a taker. I'm not a giver. And I lived like that for a long, long time. Get you through the end of this. I don't get into all the trouble stuff. Listen, I don't glorify alcoholism. I went to 1,000 concerts. I had parents that had money, right? I there was a lot of stuff in the 70s. I was everywhere. Let me tell you. If you think you had a good time drinking, get your mother, your father, your significant other, your kids, your employer, your neighbor, your co-workers, and your creditors together and ask them what kind of time they had. See, I'm about the real. I don't stand up here and glorify something that almost killed me and took the people that loved me to a place to where they were sicker than I was. It is what it is. And if you had a good time, not to, if it was so good, what you doing up in here? What you doing up in here? I don't glorify it. And this thing lives in the mind. It would love to plant a seed back there someplace that there was something redeeming about it, wouldn't it? Until one day I get restless, irritable, and discontented enough to seek that ease and comfort again. Now, honesty is the principle of step one. Wilson said 100% on step one. The rest of them, do the best you can. I don't play no games with that. I had convicted of driving under the influence of alcohol 7 times in the state of Ohio. I have no regard for you, your family, your kids, nothing. I'm a chronic drunk driver. I've been cut out of cars. I've been dead. I've been convicted on felony weapons and drug charges. And none of that. That's all podium flash. It's the stuff that's inside. At the end of my drinking, no baths, no showers, I got a liver that's extended about 7 inches. Every time I take a drink, I cough all this white stuff up. My liver and my pancreas are ceasing to function. What I'm coughing up is pure alcohol. My body is now rejecting what my mind is obsessed with. I'm 32 years old and I'm dying of alcoholism. That's the story of Ken's drinking. I live like an animal. I worked at Ford Motor Company and did not have a car. Yes, it's possible. You're looking at the man who pulled it off. True story, I did not. See, because my alcoholism is active, it don't care if I got a car. I'm going to work tonight. No, you ain't. I'm going to pay these bills. No, you ain't. I'm going to go help my mother. No. I come out of the pump lounge, I had what they call a moment of clarity, a moment of sanity. There's a guy in Cleveland, Six-Pack Charlie, who said that that's the moment when God paralyzes the liar in you long enough for you to see the truth. Out of nowhere, boom. If you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. You better get some help. You can't do it by yourself. You're running out of time. You better do it now. Just like that. I made a phone call to my best drinking buddy from college, who's a doctor now, and he helped me. I owed him a whole bunch of money. He loved me like his little brother. He still does. His house is big as this hotel. He's a very powerful man now. And I called him and I said, Rich, it's your boy, man. I need some help. This is what he told me. Pack a bag, stay by the phone, man. I got you. When I get a call from the North Central Intergroup office in Sandusky, you know what I tell them on the other end? Pack a bag, stay by the phone. I got you. And I'm going to tell you something. I got someplace to take you. I was taught to be a resource to new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. When somebody called me and asked for help, I know everybody from Betty Crocker to Betty Ford. You betcha. My brother and his wife drove me down there the next day. My father told them he'd give them $100 if they didn't bring me back. That's a true story. I had a case of Genesee beer in the back seat. I didn't know too much about treatment, but I had figured out on my own they wasn't serving no liquor down there. I got three or four of them cold Jennies in me as we sped down I-75. And here's the thought that came to me. You know, I just may have overreacted here. It ain't that bad. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Give me the effect produced by alcohol. I told my brother to turn around. He said, you got 200? Because daddy got 100. I didn't have $2. He took me to Richard's house. Richard put me in his Porsche. Put me in his Porsche. I got tears in my eyes. I have better grades than him. And I'm not trying to be egomaniac. I got in that car and I'm thinking, Kent, man, what happened to your life? What happened to your life? When did your life shift from being the person you always wanted to be to alcohol being at the center of your life? I constructed my life to accommodate my alcoholism. Anybody know what I'm talking about? And it ain't like I knew I was doing that. He bought me a quart of Miller's. We pulled in the parking lot of Green Memorial Hospital. I had this much left in the quart. He put his car in park, got the biggest smile ever seen on his face. He said, go ahead, dog, finish that. And don't ask me how I know it, man. He said, that's the last drink you're ever going to take. That was the 17th of May, 1992. I have not had another drop of alcohol or anything stronger than an aspirin since that day, and I would have never believed it possible. I'm going to tell you, that's because of God in you. It ain't got nothing to do with me. That's because of God in you. I spent 35 days in a 28-day treatment program. That'll tell you how I do treatment. 28 days, they cut my insurance off. They called up to the Ford plant. They said, we don't think Kent's ready to lead a hospital. You know what they set up the Ford plant? We don't either. They actually wrote a check, $1,000 for me to stay another week. God, it was crazy. I came home, I played a game. It's called Don't Drink, Go to Meetings, and Don't Do Nothing Else. I put my arm through a window, I cut an artery, I drive to the hospital, I'm bleeding to death. Doctor comes out and says, come on back, Mr. Coleman, we'll treat you now. I sit there bleeding to death, look at the doctor and say, no, thank you. I'll just sit here and I bleed to death in the emergency room. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the emergency room. I've been sitting in these meetings long enough now. I've watched people who attend these meetings on a daily basis die of untreated alcoholism before my very eyes. Some of them drink and some of them don't. Some of them just take a gun and end it. The treatment for the disease I suffer from is a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, period. There's a lot of stuff that supports it, but nothing that's a substitute for it. I went to over 250 meetings in 3 months, and I really did. And they'll tell you that where I live. And I ended up in the parking lot of Daly's Pub in downtown Sandusky, shaking out of my skin. I wanted to drink so bad. I said my first prayer in AA because you guys told me to pray. I'm 3 months sober. God, what am I doing wrong? Like a lightning bolt, what are you doing right? If you go to that many meetings, you hear it every day. Get a sponsor. Read the book. Work the steps. Get a home group. Help others. I didn't do none of that. I treated AA like a cigarette-smoking, donut-dunking coffee clutch. I turned the key in that car, and I drove to Lorain, Ohio, and I went and I was going to go to the Compass Group, and I was going to find either Bill or Kenny. And I said, the first one of them I see, I'm going to ask him to help me. And they were sitting together, and I asked them for some help. And what Bill said is, we'll take you through the steps as they outlined in this book, and we'll show you how we live them in our daily life. And that is exactly what they did. And that's how I try to live the steps in my life to this day, imperfectly. But I do the best I can. And man, I made amends to my parents. I made amends to my mother. She died when I was 2 years sober of bone cancer. I moved back into the house because I didn't have a safe place to live, and they let me do that. And for 2 years, I was not allowed to say I'm sorry to my mother. I was just to be the kind of son God put me here to be. And, wow. Got to the end. I got her off the morphine. Bill said, go make you direct. I sat with my mom. I had a big speech planned out. She had tears running down her face. I had tears running down my face. And the only thing I could say was, Mom, I'm sorry. And my mom beamed at me. See, my mother saw me go to all them AA meetings. My mama saw me bring my first sponsees to her kitchen table and open the big book and talk about God. My mama seen me put on a shirt and a tie and go speak at AA meetings when I didn't even have a suit. And my mom told me that. She said, I forgive you. She said, stay with them people in AA. Promised me that. I promised her that I would, and I have. My dad died. I was 17 years sober. We had a great time. Nothing left on the table between me and the old man when he left here. I made my daddy hang his head. My daddy worked at General Motors for 42 years, never missed a day's work. I made him hang his head. I got divorced at 20 years sober, moved to Las Vegas. I think if you get divorced, you ought to move to Las Vegas. To run a small plant for a company based out of Michigan. I stayed out there, but I was too far away. I got two daughters, 16 and 20, and I came back home for now. My 20-year-old is married. She's a junior at the University of Cincinnati. My baby's a junior in high school, so I got one more year. And after she's out of high school, then I'll figure out where I'm going to go. I like warm weather. I like warm weather. All right. And my life is good. My life is good. I want to say this before I leave here. If you're new here, they gave me a tape of a man named Warren Chisholm Sr. He said this: anyone who comes here who is willing to practice the principles and precepts of this program, as outlined in our book, need never drink again one day at a time. I said to my sponsor, Bill, how can he say that, never drink again one day at a time? Bill said, it's simple. He said, because this is a spiritual program, and God doesn't fail. There is no failure here. If this don't work for me, it's because I have not fulfilled the conditions that have been laid down. God will not do for me what I can do for myself. Those who do get, and those who don't. And it's just that simple. If I said anything to help you tonight, thank God. Do not thank me. If I didn't say nothing to help you tonight, guess what? It's more meetings tomorrow. God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. God could and would if He were sought. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Bye, Georgia.